got mad. Now the boat won't float. I don't like it. I'm too proud to be wrong. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. We're not a working. We're not a working. We're just not working anymore. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working
Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you by our listener-supported community radio station, WFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois. Views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent the views of the station manager, board of directors, or Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here's Gus with some underwriting announcements.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon, Urbana. For more information, visit www.centralillinoisjobswithjustice.org. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. The World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. The Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
Okay, thank you, Gus. We've got two guests today, one here in the studio with us and one that's going to be calling at 11:30. So what I want to do here is I want to read some quick public service announcements, and then we're going to turn over to our guests here in the studio. First of all, I want to let you know that the Prairie Crossroads Blues Society, the Blues Harmonica Workshop and History Lesson will be today at the Champaign Public Library, 200 West Green Street. And that's today, Saturday, November 14th, from 2 to 3:30. Free Honor Harmonics to the first 25 kids through the programs designed for grade school kids of all ages are welcome. And that's today at the Champaign Public Library from 2 to 3:30. And to let you know about also something coming up this week on Wednesday, November 18th, from 11:40 a.m. to 12:45 p.m. at the IBEW Electricians Local 601 at 3301 Broadwalk Drive, Champaign, is Clean Jobs for Workers, Our Community, and Our Future. See how clean jobs and clean energy are right for Illinois' economy, workers, and environment. We'll begin with a tour of the local solar arrays and wind turbines at the IBEW Local 1140, followed by a press conference at 12 noon. Join State Representative Carol Ammons, Labor, People of Faith, and other Friends of the Earth as we come together to show that Illinois is ready for clean jobs. And last but not least, this Sunday and every Sunday from 4 to 5 p.m. is Labor's World View TV on Comcast Channel 6 and live worldwide at UrbanaPublicTelevision.org. This Sunday from 4 to 5 will be the history of the IWW. So, okay, now I'd like to introduce our first guest. Guest, why don't you introduce yourself to listeners yourself?
So I'm Andrew Scheinman. actually, before I introduce myself, let me just say that my heart goes out, and I think all of our hearts go out to what happened in Paris, for the people that died, for the families of the people that died, for the families of the terrorists who killed them, for the Muslims throughout the world who are working for peace like everybody else, because this is not an act of Muslim anything, it's an act of terrorism. So I just wanted to put myself in that perspective because that's something more important than anything I have to say. So as far as what I have to say, I describe myself as an inverted Oreo. I was born in New York City, grew up in Urbana, so I have the thick vanilla exterior of a Midwesterner with a caustic heart of a New Yorker eating its way out. My reason for being here this morning is I'm the person who filed the vast majority of the FOIAs in the Salida case, which I did because I had been filing FOIAs relating to the U of I's partnership with Carl to build the medical center.
Okay, let me stop you right there for a second. For those who are unfamiliar, a FOIA is a Freedom of Information Act.
Exactly.
Okay.
So, and Salida.
And also, too, Stephen Salida.
Professor.
Talk a little bit about him and why there was such.
Right, Professor Stephen Salida. Maybe you could just talk real briefly about who he
is. Okay, so I'll give you my own quick. So here's as fast as I can possibly do this.
Okay.
So I grew up here. I got a PhD at UCLA. I became a patent lawyer in Stark Companies. I came back here to take care of my mother who has dementia. I volunteered my time at the research park here. And I was rebuffed because, in my opinion, it's a hotbed of nepotism and crony capitalism at its worst.
Sounds like the building trade.
So, not to say that they haven't done great things, they have, but that for a public university to have that kind of mission, not even creep, but falling off a cliff, bad thing. So, I began to file FOIAs to find out what was going on with the medical center, and the reason for that is that Carl is in a battle with Urbana over taxes, and the university picking sides by partnering with Carl was a bad thing. And it turns out from all of the Freedom of Information Act filings, especially the ones that the university ultimately divulged as having been sent on personal emails, showed that Chancellor, ex-Chancellor Wise, was meeting routinely with Jim Leonard, CEO of Carl, behind closed doors, blah, 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 blah. All right, so in any case, fast forward to Salida, and I've been doing that for multiple years. Salida was a professor that was hired to teach here. He deferred his coming for about a year, and immediately before he was going to teach in Indian Studies, American Indian Studies, AIS, and before he came here, he did something that those of us who are old and cynical would recognize as having been unwise, which was he made public statements of a kind that people at the university didn't like.
Right. In particular, what it was the summer when the Israelis did a full-blown bombing assault on Gaza, in which I think it was some I don't know how many people, but there was hundreds of children killed.
Yeah.
And I guess there was images being, of course, not on the corporate media, but basically broadcast through alternative media and social media around the world. And Professor Salida saw some pictures of dead children, and he reacted, in, like you said, in an emotional, angry way by making a personal tweet. This was not on a university email or anything else. It was his own personal, you know, social media, basically condemning the Israeli actions, correct?
And, oh, yeah, by the way, though, I want to throw in here, this has to do with him being in American Indian Studies because he, his perspective compares the plight of the Palestinians currently with what happened to the American Indians historically.
Okay, Andrew.
So there's, and there's a lot of backstory there. I'll just give you my perspective,
okay,
which is that I think that the tweets were uncouth, but I don't think that they were anti-Semitic. I'm Jewish, so for whatever, to whatever extent I represent the Jewish people, which is not very much, you know, I think that they were stupid. I think that they came out of anger, which, you know, okay, what can you say? Anyway, what happened was the U of I unhired him, and it led to a huge controversy because it was seen as an attempt to suppress Palestinian voices of dissent. It was seen as a violation of policy regarding academic hirings, and so trampling on the rights of faculty.
And a breach of contract as well?
Well, and so ultimately what happened was Salida was represented by the CCR, Center for Constitutional Rights, in New York City, which advocates for Palestinian voices as well as having represented a Gitmo. And they sued the university, claiming a number of things in federal court, including First Amendment violations and contract violations. And to flash forward after this, the Salida tweets were in July of last year, and 2 days ago, a settlement was announced. $875,000 to be paid to Salida and his lawyers, $600,000 to Salida with no offer of job, which he had originally said would be the only thing that he would consider, $275,000 to his lawyers, and then the U of I paid $1.3 million to their own attorneys, who probably spent a good portion of that money not fighting Salida, but investigating ethical breaches internal to U of I.
Yeah, no admission of wrongdoing on the university's part. As you said, no position at the university. In fact, we still don't know what Salida's, will he ever work in an American university at this point? And
yeah, cause he's teaching right now, I believe, in Beirut, Lebanon,
Beirut.
Right?
So the question right now that we see, and I think in terms of looking at this from a perspective of how legalism works or how we move forward, and we had this discussion before the show, outside of the university now knowing how not to fire somebody without getting sued, what is different from before the Salida demonstration versus now after the settlement? Because right now, the only win I see is Professor Salida now has this pressure off of his shoulders. I mean, very traumatic and emotional, you know, going through this lawsuit, that's fine and all. But in terms of the university and the culture of abusing power by the administration, being able to really just take advantage of the right, the fact that the faculty does not have a union. I mean, there's so many things that are still in place, so many abuses of power and domination at the university now that have not been addressed or even looked at. I mean, seriously, like, so for people that are listening, my argument is that we can't look at the Salida case as being the central focus for a social movement against the abuses of power at the university. Not just because of the settlement, because again, that's something that we couldn't control. But my argument is that, first of all, it's a legalist tactic, and we know from history that legalist tactics have never been successful in restructuring society. So restructuring a private capitalist-like university, like the University of Illinois, it was never going to happen that way. We have to look at it from creating an internal consciousness about the abuses of power and our social condition of being oppressed at the university to form a social movement to restructure and stop those abuses. That's where I look at it from. So
I'm just going to jump in here. So I'm old enough that while my heart is moved by that if I move my heart that much, I'll have a heart attack and drop dead. So I try to bite off smaller pieces because, you know, my teeth are falling out and all that sort of stuff. So, but it's a really perfect segue because the thing is, okay, Salida took the settlement. Some people don't like that, but the guy has kids, and I don't think that he was so smart in what he said, although he had every right to say it. But it's his choice, and I don't think anyone should condemn him or ask him to have done more. He did his duty. Now the question is what happens next? And that question is bifurcated into what happens in a national sense, because there was a huge amount of national attention about this, and there will continue to be because the American Association of University Professors sanctioned the University of Illinois for having done this, and that sanction is what the U of I administration now wants lifted, and so that ties into a national perspective. And then there's the more important, or at least more important right now, question of what happens locally, because, okay, Salida's out of the case, the giant pressure on the U of I, which came from his lawsuit, is now gone. And so the question is, all right, are we here, and by we I mean lots of disparate groups who might have nothing in common other than I hope to want to come together to see the truth brought out, because you can't go forward without the truth. So the question is, how do we go forward, and what truth needs to come out in order for that to happen? What truth has come out thus far? The truth that's come out thus far is that the university is willing to pay $2.1 million to make Salida go away and pay off their own attorneys. Again, $600,000 to Salida, $275,000 to his nonprofit lawyers, and $1.3 million to the lawyers that probably spent most of their time investigating the university's ethical breaches and breaches of the law. So, Salida's gone. The lawsuit's over. The state courts were called upon to rule on the release of 10,000 pages of emails regarding Salida. They found that those needed to be released. That happened in June. Had no hide nor hair of those, and now we're almost 6 months later. That would be a good start for moving forward, is to get that information out there. The university had an ethics report that was done on Chancellor Wise's use of personal emails to avoid FOIAs. She did that because of me, because of my FOIAs on Carl, that long predated Salida, but she continued to do that with Salida. She also said in her early emails that she was destroying documents. Where's the truth on that? Where's the ethics report on that? Is it unreasonable to ask that that be released to the public so that we know what happened? Is it unreasonable to think that in order to move forward, we have to do a little bit of truth and reconciliation and find out what happened? And here's why that's important. It's because this isn't just about Salida. This is about how the university treats faculty. It's about how it treats its employees. And more broadly, it's about to what extent it's going to be a public entity that's based on the principle, at least in theory, of disclosure and openness rather than a private entity based on the theory of for profit, for the elite, for whatever. So I'm not going to launch into invective based on power and the, you know, disequality, although I feel all of those things. It's a very simple thing that I think what we all need to do right now, here's the tagline. What we all need to do right now is we all need to come together regardless of outlook and say that something really bad happened, and that no matter what you believe about Salida and no matter what you believe about faculty unions, absent the release of real information and a real house cleaning, no one is going to benefit. No one is going to learn anything, and we're never going to move forward.
Gus? I agree with that, but again, house cleaning from the top down has never really done anything. I do agree that we as the students of the university, we need to use political education to talk about the Salida issue and be critical in analyzing it from the beginning to the end, so that we can draw upon and understand our condition in this issue, because this is not just an abuse of power by the university itself. This is abuse of power by really the state for allowing this to go the way it did. So my main thing is this, is that we have to develop our own consciousness and develop our own movement to figure how to basically solve the issues that the Salida, because again, this is not strictly about Salida. One of the things I wanted to make very clear when we started this movement, last summer, was that this is not simply an isolated incident and what happened to Stephen Salida. This is a pattern of abuses by the university against professors, against students. And of course, we cannot forget James Kilgore. This is clearly, except what happened with Kilgore is the fight went on, and now Kilgore is now teaching at the university because of that people power, both in the community and the campus, getting together, issuing demands and never stopping the fight. So again, that's what I'm saying. That's why I honestly believe that we can look at the Salida decision as something that, I'm excuse me, the Salida episode as something that, yes, something horrible happened. But again, if we look at it from the perspective of, yeah, we expected more to come out of a court case of all things, knowing how historically court cases have worked, they've only benefited the liberals and the conservatives. There was really never going to be a restructuring of society or restructuring of a private profit-based university system like the University of Illinois. It was never going to change. I mean, they make over $900 million in tuition profits alone.
Profits.
Yeah, they bring in that much after tuition.
After all their expenses.
And that's only tuition. We can't count
all the grants and the gifts, and we
still have a tenure faculty that has no union. We have a non-tenure track faculty that can't get a contract because the administration is so disgusting and insidious that they won't sit at the table with them and actually argue a contract. We have graduate students who are making well below living standards. We have undergraduate students whose tuition is so high that they have to actually work two jobs in some cases. I mean, all of this stuff, and the Salida case is mixed into that. All of these things stem from one issue, is the abuse of power by the administration, the Board of Trustees, to disrespect and not really acknowledge the humanity of Salida, of students, of professors, and other groups. We have to take that. We have to actually break down the data, get the numbers out, politically educate ourselves, develop a movement, make demands for change.
And do you think part of that would be like what Andrew said about getting this stuff made public? All these
I think that's a part of it. I don't think that's going to be the central.
But this is one of the best universities.
Well, it's supposed to be one of the best public universities, and I think that's the whole point. This is supposed to be a public university.
Learning and labor.
Land grant college. So the thing that's interesting now going forward is that there's already this interesting thing where a number of people put out, faculty and some other people put out a call for things not to end where they have with Salida. And what's interesting about that is that there's been a call, that's a good thing, but on the other hand, the CFA has probably rightfully pointed out that this all needs to be coordinated because, you know, a movement requires that all of the individual elements, each of whom may have somewhat of their own outlook, unite for a common cause. And so, I'm not going to disagree with anything that was just said because I agree with it. But for me, the going forward, and this is where I hope that the audience listening will participate, is that there needs to be a groundswell. And it's not a groundswell based about whether or not you like Salida or whether or not you're for or against faculty unions, although my guess is the people that are listening to this probably are. But that the groundswell needs to be, and again, I'm picking a fairly moderate endpoint, but I think it's an important one that serves as the basis for everything else. And that comes back to the point that this is a public university. And not only is it a public university, but it is a great public university, in that even though the Salida affair is egg on its face, it is a great public university, and we are proud of it. But you know what? It can do better. And you know what? This needs to all be brought out into the open for public discussion, and that requires that the university undertake that, and it requires the university to be pressured to do that. So what I'm willing to do, and in fact more than happy to do, is I have learned far too much about FOIA filings for my own good. I will be happy, but I know, and let me tell you that the state is involved in this. The Attorney General's office will not grant me journalist status, because to have done so would have allowed me to file many more FOIAs than I had filed. The Attorney General's office is having backdoor communications with the University of Illinois legal counsel. I don't like to look for conspiracies where they may or may not exist, but there are bad things happening. And so I am more than happy and, in fact, eager to teach people how to exercise their right as a citizen and file FOIAs and bring this out into the open, coordinate their... I mean, here's another one. So the University of Illinois archives were originally going to take my FOIA filings and put them up for public view. And guess what? they were too afraid to do so because they were afraid of the university coming down on them for it. Guess what? I was working with a DI reporter on some of the Carl stuff, and the university, Robin Kaler, as I recall, the spokesperson, they called him into their offices and asked him point blank, who's your source? Which, to do that to one of their own student journalists, and of course he, being afraid of them, told them, is a travesty. So, again, my point of view is sort of omnivorous, but it's that this stuff cannot be allowed to fester, and that no progress will be made until this comes out in the open, all of it. And no matter who you are, you should want that.
The university is great only because of us. Let's be clear. So all everybody listening, the students, the staff, the professors, we're the reason we make the university great in our labor and just how, and the things that we do on the campus. Yeah. No, the administrators, no, they don't. In fact, the administrators are regressing the university and is no longer a public university. It is now a private. When you enter that profit margin, you become a private university.
And it's and I think the Stephen Slider brought some of this out too. I mean, think about the whole motivation behind here was that the Phyllis Weiss and the other administrators were afraid of offending certain wealthy donors, and private donors to the U of I.
And that's why we have to look at the example of the Missouri campus right now. We have to look at what they did. They had a pattern of events, just like at the University of Illinois, except instead of going the legalist route, which people tried to rally around Salida and think that that was going to be a change. What they did was they hosted political education from the group Concerned Student 1950. And black students, particularly the football players, joined in rallying with Jonathan Butler, the leader of Concerned Student 1950. And then other groups, white students, professors, departments, other groups came along and they did this thing together.
So let me ask you a question. So because I'm old and have little time on this earth, this is a joke. But, so what would you have people do today? I mean, because this is the question. So now we're in a moment of pause where Salida is out of the picture, and God bless him, he did stupid things, and I don't agree with some of what he said, but, you know, his right. What do we do now? What do we do today? What do we tomorrow? And who are we, and how are you going to build a big tent to make that happen?
Well, the first thing is that the student groups on campus that are so enamored with the stuff going on in terms of oppression, they hold public forums both on campus and in the community and bring both groups together, which we've done a very good job of doing already, but now doing it in a mass level and educating about the conditions of the campus and the community.
So can we set up a going forward meeting to talk about Salida in public?
Going forward meeting?
Well, okay. So again, we're at an inflection point. We're at a point where something happened. The result is at least partially satisfying in that the university did something. Colleen has not been here long enough for us to condemn him for his actions or inactions. He seems okay. But I, you know, the organizing requires organizing, and organizing requires raising your head. So I'm just asking, okay, it's great that those events have been going on. Can an event be made to happen soon? Or a series of events?
Well, that's the thing. It has to be a series of events. Okay, remember, consistency.
So can that be done? I will be happy to show my pathetic face to teach people how to file FOIAs, and I'll do that every time I have a chance.
Well, I appreciate the FOIA thing being important, but again, nothing gets done on the campus until students raise voices and have collective actions. I agree FOIAs are important, but collective action is very much so how we're going to push this thing forward.
Okay, let's pick this conversation up here right after our caller. Hello, WFT, you're on the air. Hello, WFT, you're on the air. Okay, well, I don't seem to have anybody on that line, but caller, if it's who I think it is, Michael Garcia, please call back at 217-FLY-LIVE, 217-FLY-LIVE.
Yeah, but like I was saying, though, the biggest thing that we have to recognize is that we need to study the movements of the past to understand how change happens on college campuses.
Yeah, but
everybody needs to be studying, and we need to be in these meetings and series. We need to talk about...
Okay, let's try it.
The other line, baby.
Who's calling in? Hello, WFT, you're on the air.
Well, that wasn't a very good idea. I called in on line two to leave line open.
Paul, can you... yes, listen, we're not taking calls right now.
The only thing I wanted to add was, just very quickly, is that one thing that has to be added in is the Native American Studies unit and the suppression. portion of the discourse about...
Paul, I'm cutting you off. I got a caller calling in. Goodbye. Hello, WFT, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm Michael Garcia from the Industrial Workers of the World.
Hi, Michael, how you doing? Okay, could you, okay, you just introduced yourself to the listeners, so I guess we'll go right into it. So you're the Industrial Workers of the World, and you are, I don't know the actual title, but sort of like you're in charge of the Midwest organizing, more or less?
I actually chair the General Executive Board of the entire union.
Oh, okay. All right, very good.
So, and we're charged with overseeing the day-to-day operations of the union in between conventions.
Okay. And so I know when we talked before by email, you said that you didn't really want to go into anything about the history of the IWW. In fact, my television, public access television program is going to be on tomorrow documenting that quite well. So today we want to talk about what the IWW has been doing here in the recent past, presently, as well as what you have plans for the future. So just proceed if you'd like.
Yeah, the modern day IWWs, we've got a lot of exciting things going on. Just this year alone, we've, granted charters to, four new branches, one actually up in Duluth and, Superior. It's called the Twin Forks branch. We've got two new regional organizing committees, which are kind of, their own entities, in Greece and Ireland, or Iceland, my mistake. We've got 22 recognized union shops, right now. And that includes sole proprietors. I actually have a sole proprietor, union shop in Salt Lake City where I'm from.
Mm-hmm.
We've chartered two new, groups. One is the Junior Wobblies, and that's been a really big help to bring, one of the problems the IWW has long had is retaining members. And a lot of times when people hit that post-college, I got my first real job, I have a family, they kind of drift away from the union, and the Junior Wobblies has been a way to kind of incorporate families and giving them a space in the union so people can kind of grow with their family and grow with the union.
Okay.
We've also, our actual largest, group that's, growing in the IWW presently is the incarcerated workers.
And okay.
They're chartered as a separated branch. We have close to 700 prisoners that have signed up into the IWW in the last couple of years.
700 prisoners. Wow, that's really interesting. Yeah. Okay.
We've also got some really good stuff up in Toronto. They have the harm reduction workers, which is probably our biggest public campaign we've had in recent history. There's over 100 people that have joined onto that campaign in Toronto alone.
And what is that campaign exactly?
They work with kind of, at the point of people trying to, kind of with the homeless and with, addicts and just trying to get people back on their feet,
mm-hmm.
for the most part. And a lot of them are former, users and whatnot themselves. So they're very, kind of a very, different set of workers.
Okay.
A lot of them are trying to reestablish themselves. A lot of them are volunteer based,
mm-hmm.
but they're really actually working a lot to help people in the community. They do a lot of stuff to prevent like transfers of diseases between drug users and stuff like that. So it's really work that needs to be done in communities to help keep people safe that are maybe not they don't fit into the normal parts of the world, I guess. So
yeah. Okay, well, you know, this is interesting because this is one thing that the IWW organizing model is very unique compared to other American unions in the sense that you don't just go after workplaces and groups of workers. You also organize people like prisoners or, not just students, but also homemakers, housewives can belong because that's considered work, unpaid as
right.
It usually is. This is what's always been, not to mention historically, it's the only thing I'm going to say about historically, the IWW was one of the very first American unions that would organize African Americans and women into their organization.
Oh, yeah, to be honest with you, it's still currently the only one that didn't create racially segregated locals.
Yes.
So, yeah, to this
okay.
day.
Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, I kind of look at, like, the Fight for 15, which is a big moniker now with fast food workers. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, 10 years ago, the IWW was organizing in Borders Books. We were in Starbucks. We were in Jimmy John's.
Yep.
And that was kind of the whole precursor to this whole movement where, like, people thought, oh, wow, we can actually go after and organize the people that are never going to be organized because they're unskilled labor. And I think part of that really shows that we're trying to promote the idea of class consciousness. Mm-hmm. People have a hard time looking, people look down on other jobs because, you know, fast food workers, people think like, oh, well, why did they deserve that? Well, you know, everybody deserves it. It's not just them. But, you know, if we can change the tide for fast food and service workers, then that's going to really change the tide for everybody else that's working. And we just need to realize that nobody's better than anybody else. We all have to work to survive. So we're really doing our part to try to raise class consciousness and let people understand, you know,
yes,
what it is to be a worker and have respect for everybody.
Yes, you know, I attended the 100th year anniversary 10 years ago in Chicago, the Industrial Workers of the World. And what really struck me up there was, I thought it was quite a diverse age group up there. I mean, I saw people look like they were 80s and 90s, and I saw other people that looked like they were like junior high or high school age. And then, of course, the biggest group, of course, were people that looked like in their 20s, you know, and 30s. And also it really struck me that there was great care, you know, taken to make sure that families that came that had daycare services during the course of the celebrate, because really it was kind of a convention. And what also was interesting, I thought, was that for breakfast and lunch it was always vegetarian and vegan stuff, but at dinner they continued to have vegetarian and vegan stuff, but somebody, one of the IWW members, actually brought an elk that they cooked, that he actually hunted himself. I guess it was a member from out west, you know, so it's, yeah, so I thought it really struck me as a very, very diverse group, both age as well as I guess a geographical and cultural background.
Yeah, that's definitely something that I think we're really proud of. And I think one of the greatest things is, we used to lose that member in their 30s. We never had that around. And now we have this new generation of people that have been in the IWW for 10 years. They have some really solid organizing behind them, and they're continuing to be members and growing, through that. So we've got this new population that the IWW has really never seen. There's not a lot of people like me. I joined, 25 years ago.
Okay.
I was 20 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So, next week is actually my 25th anniversary being involved in the IWW.
Congratulations.
But I'm only 45 years old.
Okay.
There's plenty of people in the union my age now, but there's only a few people that have actually been in the union as long as I have been.
Okay.
So it's there's a really different dichotomy. And the reasons that what brings people into the union, I think the reasons are changing. We definitely do grasp and we do celebrate our history.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a lot of people don't realize that the IWW has progressed beyond the history, just the historical significance.
Mm-hmm.
I live in Salt Lake City, Utah. Next week is a huge week for us. We're celebrating the centennial of Joe Hill's execution.
Yes.
I live about 3 miles from the spot that he was shot at.
Okay.
It's a really big deal for us.
Mm-hmm.
But we also don't want to be known as the Joe Hill Historical Society as
sure,
well.
Sure.
So we take our time to respect the people that came before us, but we're also like, making a stand saying like, no, we're actually here, and organizing people now.
Yes. In November, we remember the common phrase in the IWW.
Yeah, most definitely.
Let me ask you about some of those, job, shops that you have organized. You said there's some 22 different ones. Foods, co-op food stores. Is that a common one?
We've got a couple of co-ops. Mm-hmm. We've actually got, some people organizing in co-ops. In Seattle right now, they're actually in negotiations.
Mm-hmm.
We've got P&L Press in Denver. They're a full-scale printing operation.
Mm-hmm.
They actually print a lot of stuff for us.
Mm-hmm.
The sole proprietorships can, like, vary. We've got a bike collective.
Oh, okay.
It's a bicycle shop in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
We have a busker's union in Windsor, Canada right now.
A what union? I'm sorry? A what?
A busker's union. They busker's. Basically are taking the street musicians, but they're actually doing more than just the busker's. They're actually like tying this all into a community center that's actually helping a lot of the street artists and the people that live on the street actually in their community as well. So, so we've got a kind of a diverse group of shops.
Mm-hmm.
Right now we're actually in conversation with some monument builders. They're stone carvers that are looking to become an IWW recognized shop. So.
Okay. I noticed that a lot of, I mean, there's two different kinds of people, it seems like, that join the IWW. I mean, there's probably more and more. But what I noticed was it was people that could, you know, immediately benefit from, you know, having a union representation about basically, you know, being in a collective action with their coworkers and demanding more money, benefits, job conditions. But I also know there's a lot of dual car holders. In other words, members of unions who want to join the IWW for various reasons, mainly because they're not happy with the union they're part of. And I know being a retired carpenter in the Carpenters Union, I knew a lot of building trades members that were dual car holders, mainly out west in, like, you know, Colorado, Montana, Wyoming, and stuff.
Dave, I got a historical tidbit.
Well, we're not supposed to talk about history.
Well,
so.
This is kind of recent. Okay. I'm a laborer. Okay. In 1926, the laborers union made it illegal to hold an IWW card.
Specifically stated the IWW.
Yeah. And I think that lasted until the, Supreme Court decision in the 60s, with, Helen Flynn. And that's when you also used to have to swear that you weren't a communist before you could be a steward or something.
Yes, okay.
But that also knocked down the laborer's law, too, I believe.
Okay, yeah. So, Michael, you are aware of this, or you want to comment on it? Or?
You know, we don't have any issues with people belonging dual carding for us, unless you're a paid...
organizer, staffer for a union?
Yeah, then that can be a little bit of a gray area.
Pie cards.
Yeah, pie cards, okay.
But, exactly. But yeah, we have a lot of dual cards. We have people in the, definitely the construction industry. IUC30 was based out of Montana. That was all over the Intermountain West. We have a lot of people, communication workers. We have a lot of teachers that are dual card carriers. And we actually, we do dual card strategy. The idea is that people from within are trying to change their business unions to think more industrially and more open to not just think of themselves. We have some people working in the Walmart campaigns in California. It's one of the places that they've had the most success in their campaigns. And all of their organizers are dual carders with the IWW. So their actions are a lot more militant, and they do a lot more direct action style goals. But the whole time they're still in their union. They're still organizing people in their union, but they're using the IWW philosophy and pushing those forward. And because all of their organizers in this group are Wobblies, they're being able to do it really quickly and implement these things.
So, okay. Well, okay. Listen, we've run out of time here, so I just wanted to give you last some parting words and maybe some contact info for our listeners.
Yeah, the easiest way to get a hold of in contact with the IWW is you can go to our website. It's IWW.org. And just click on headquarters, and there's contact information. You can, if anybody contacts the headquarters, they'll go through and process it, and then they'll pass that contact information on to the people that are representing those areas of the country.
Okay.
And then, you know, I get them all the time. I pick up the phone and I call somebody, and if I can meet them, I arrange a time to go meet them, and we talk to them and do what we can do to help them out, or if they're interested in joining, we can get them working.
Okay, and that's IWW.org. And Bill?
And by the way, speaking of history, that website has a lot of really good, interesting history about the IWW. And it's epic. It's the stuff of legends.
Yes.
Really.
Indeed.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Okay. All right, Michael, well, thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you.
Take care.
I dreamed of Fall Joe Hill last night, live with you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake, Joe, great God, says I am standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I ain't dead. Says Joe, but I ain't dead. The copper bosses, they framed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe. I did not die, says Joe. I did not die. And standing there just as big as life, smiling with his eyes, says he what they forgot to kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego on up to Maine and every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, says he'll find Joe Hill, says he'll find Joe Hill. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, live as you and me, says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead, I never died, says he, I never died, says he.
Okay, we're back at the World Labor Hour, and I want to thank Michael Garcia, the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, otherwise known as the Wobblies, for calling in and everything. And I want to pick up on this conversation, and then I'm going to open up the phone lines. So I guess who wants to start first? Andrew, Gus?
Well, my mate, the only point I'm trying to clarify is that I believe that foying is a great tactic, but in terms of strategy, it needs to be a more radical strategy than looking at it strictly from a legalist perspective. So what I'm saying is that the people that are disappointed by this settlement, they shouldn't be surprised or disappointed, and that the power of the people is going to come from the ground up, and to organize political education means, and once you're politically educated about your conditions, then you can create tactics of radical power against the university, where you do, some groups are foreuing, some groups are protesting, some groups are doing sit-ins. That look at the Mizzou situation. So that's what I'm saying. It can be different tactics after political education takes place in different arenas and different groups on the campus. Mm-hmm. So, but we can't stake a restructuring of society and restructuring of the university on a liberal ideology legally.
Sure. What organization on campus do you think would be best to maybe get the ball rolling on this? You know, like what Andrew was talking about, you know, as far as, you know, not just the, you know, FOIAs, yeah, plus the organizing that you're talking about.
There's some really good undergraduate groups right now that are making a lot of noise, like Lakata, a great Latino student group. They're getting ready to put their newspaper back out again.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So definitely a lot of the Latina student groups on campus in terms of graduate student groups. Mm-hmm. Of course, the GEO.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, we're getting ready for bargaining in 2017, and we got some stuff.
This would be a good way to turn the heat
up
already.
We got some stuff coming very soon that people need to be paying attention to. But yeah, people are really getting excited now about bargaining coming up. And you know, that's a great space to do a lot of these different types of events.
And what about the campus faculty association? I mean, this would seem like it'd be kind of a pretty good fit. What do you think, Andrew?
So, I mean, first of all, when I talk about FOIAs, I'm not talking about those to the exclusion of other things. But I'll tell you what I think is particularly incredible about FOIAs, and that is that what I did ended up with Chancellor Wise's being removed. And it wasn't because of me, it was because she chose to avoid FOIAs by using her personal emails. But in terms of mobilizing people to do things, it really helps when you mobilize and you see your voice have an effect. And so I'm not pushing FOIAs to the exclusion of other things, but I will tell you that learning that there is, I mean, here's the deal, you know, let's talk about the Wobblies. So I just learned that today is the 100th anniversary of Joe Hill's
execution. Actually, it's the 19th coming up next week.
Of Joe Hill's execution.
Correct.
So for those of you who don't know, Joe Hill was from Sweden, Joe Hillstrom. He was an organizer in the early history of American labor. And he was, well, opinions vary, but basically he was executed in Utah because he was a union organizer. And if you look at the history of American labor, whether or not you like unions, labor unions came into existence because people had no rights. They had no rights except the right to die. And the thing that motivates people is seeing their voice have an effect. And so I'm for all forms of action that cause that, but I'll tell you that there's a legal apparatus that exists that actually can take your voice and amplify it a millionfold. And that filing FOIA happens to be one. It's an amazing thing when you can write an email to the university in 5 minutes and they have to answer you. And they have to answer you in 2 weeks and they have to disclose documents. And I'm not suggesting that you ever use that to harass them or to use it for some illicit purpose, but what I would like to see now, on. What I think is critical to see now is that the Salida affair not be lost in the chuff, but that action be taken and coordinated actions and concerted actions. And that students, I think the worst thing for students these days is that they feel that they're powerless, that their voices aren't heard. We need to change that.
Okay, and Bill, I'm going to turn it over to you. I'm just going to say real quick, I'm going to open up the phone lines. You can call in at 217-359-5483. Bill?
Okay, well, I got a little more history, and actually should have talked about this last week. However, November 11th, that happened this week is
Armistice Day.
Armistice Day.
I'm sorry. It's Veterans Day.
Veterans Day.
It used to be called Armistice Day.
Yeah. Well, it was also the anniversary of the execution of the Haymarket.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
Okay.
How strange.
Yeah. This is from a website called The Daily Bleed.
Okay.
Which is a really good website. It's basically a calendar of anarchist, avant-garde, revolutionary events and arts and everything else.
Yeah.
Okay, and this would be from the Chicago Reader, Haymarket Revisited. Four labor activists accused of murdering seven Chicago police officers at the Haymarket riot the year before were executed by hanging in Illinois. On May 4th, 1886, a labor rally was held in Chicago's Haymarket Square to protest shooting of several strikers by Chicago police the day before. Midway into the demonstration, made up of mostly German-born workers, a squad of nearly 200 policemen arrived to break up the rally. As they began to forcibly disperse the crowd, a bomb was thrown into the advancing police by a person never positively identified. Policeman Matthias J. Deegan died almost instantly. Seven other officers died later and over 60 others wounded. I don't know if that's 60. I don't know if that's 60 officers or 60 other people.
Okay.
A grand jury indicted 31 labor radicals in connection with the bombing, and eight men were finally convicted. Judge Joseph E. Gary imposed a death sentence on seven of the men, and the eighth was sentenced to 15 years. Samuel Fielden, Adolf Fisher, August Spies, and Albert Parson, executed by hanging, were the first labor activists to be executed in America. Of the other three sentenced to death, one commits suicide.
That supposedly.
Lewis Ling biting the,
the blasted dynamite blasting cap. How did he get one of those in his jail cell, please?
It's
just
framed,
like the woman down in Texas, hanging herself with a garbage
bag. It's framed as him not giving the state his life.
Okay.
You know, him doing it himself.
Yeah.
It still begs
the question of how he got a blasting cap.
Yeah, but most radical historians look at it that way.
Well, whatever.
Okay. The sentences to other, as a matter of fact, you can probably get dopeys here in a prison in here.
Okay. We're going to take this call real quick. Hold that thought though. This is good stuff. Okay. So, all right. Caller, you're on the air.
Jim Iman checking in.
Hi, Jim. What's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to make a correction. The first union in America that had all ethnic groups was the American Railway Union under Eugene V. Debs.
There's another one. Sorry, Jim. The Knights of Labor would organize anybody.
Yeah, all right. I'll give you that one.
But the Knights of Labor really wasn't a union. It was more of a social movement.
Well,
really.
It was underground. It had to be underground.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, let's not split hairs here. Okay.
They were born in La Crosse, Wisconsin.
Okay.
Okay. But the ARU, and they had one great victory, which was James J. Hill and the Great Northern Railroad. They won that strike, and that's put them on the list. And the second one was the Pullman strike, and that was a failure, and the government intervened and threw Debs in jail. And
broke up the union, by the way, into a bunch of individual craft unions. Is that correct?
Yes, exactly.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, they probably were fighting against each other at a certain point, just like the building trade.
Sure, still to this day, in fact, yes. Yeah, and I never had him explain the difference between craft unions and industrial unions for those listeners that aren't aware. Is that an industrial union means that in a given workplace or industry, everybody's organized in the same union. For instance, let's say down here the street at the hospital at Carl, not just the nurses or the doctors in one union, but you got the nurses, the doctors, the custodians, the secretaries, everybody. So that when there's a need to go on strike, that everybody walks out and shuts the whole place down, as opposed to one group going out and they get the other groups, you know, the other other workers and other unions to cross the picket lines.
Or they're out of work and so they resent the other union.
Correct. Correct.
And that happens with airlines.
Yeah.
And also too, the building trades.
Yes.
If you suggest the idea of having an all building trades union to an electrician,
mm-hmm.
that electrician will say, oh no, then I'll just be making the same as a laborer.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a very, our guests had been talking about class consciousness.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of class consciousness in the building trades, but of the wrong kind.
Mm-hmm. Jimmy, still there?
Oh, sorry.
Okay.
That is one of my
I think I lost Jim here, so okay, we'll go back to our conversation. Okay, Bill, finish what you were talking about there. You left off, I believe, at, where did you leave off at? I know you're talking about the Haymarket
martyrs. Yes, that's true. A grand jury indicted 31 labor radicals in connection with the bombing, and 8 men were finally convicted. Judge Joseph V. Gary imposed a death sentence on 7 of the men, and the 8th was sentenced to 15 years. Samuel Field and Adolf Fisher, August Spies, and Albert Parson, an interesting person in general, in his own right.
Married to Lucy Parsons,
former Confederate war.
Married an African-American, American Indian woman, yes.
They were executed by hanging, and they were the first labor activists to be executed in America. Of the other 3 sentenced to death, one supposedly commits suicide, and the sentences of the other 2 are commuted from death to life imprisonment as a result of public doubts about their actual responsibility in the massacre. In 1893, Illinois Governor John P. Altgeld, and for all you people that look at state university campuses, you see those stone castle-like buildings? Those are all Altgeld Halls built in his honor. In 1893, Governor John P. Altgeld pardons the 3 activists still imprisoned. And you know what, Dave? One of the things that I remember from high school was that, you know, how you had your series of historical films.
Yeah.
The only 2 I remember was one that featured the incident at Owl Creek Bridge about the Civil War execution, and a film about the Haymarket martyrs.
They actually showed you a film in BMET or you went to school?
And I really remembered it very well. It really stuck with me.
Just to interject here, although my recollection of labor history is a little rusty. I mean, the thing to keep in mind is the times where you have European unrest because of horrible labor conditions. And as I recall, you have a hatred of the recent German immigrants. So what you have you have Sacco and Vanzetti in the, 30s or 40s, and there it's a hatred, hatred of Italians. And so there's one theme here, which is why American labor came into existence and why it's important and why there are lots of things that you can say are fantastically good about it. The other thing is that the typical thing, this is history repeating itself over and over and over again, which is that any immigrant group becomes the target of lack of trust, fear, and mistreatment, which is not to say that other people aren't feared, mistrusted, and mistreated.
See, what they say about the German immigrants that time, oh yes, I remember, there are a bunch of crazy beer-drinking radicals. You know, and it's funny because, you know, you have similar people, you know, degrading, you know, people of, you know, of Latino origin, especially Mexican or Central American. Yeah.
Well, see, and again, this is... Germans are socialists, the Italians are anarchists.
Yeah.
Well, see, and I'm going to come back to this.
Irish were drunks.
This looking forward thing, which is that, you know, for people now, for young people now, or for anyone now who's looking to be involved, there are larger lessons to all of these things, mm-hmm. which take them out of these little boxes. I mean, you get to be an age where you remember all of the individual hurts and insults, and so you talk about those at great length. But these all fall into this same common theme, and so teaching students that labor unions came into existence because the right that people had was the right to die for an inadequate wage is not a ride. And that you know, the U of I thing, to put it in larger perspective, and I'm not going to beat the drum on this, but there are lots of issues here that need to be examined, and they fall very neatly within everything that's happened before. And these things, there's a line that I was talking about before I came on from Cloud Atlas, where the genetically engineered says, "I wasn't genomed to change reality," and the other person says, "No revolutionary ever was." So for the people out there listening, and for students in particular, you know, reality gets changed one voice at a time, but if you participate, things can happen.
Okay, any last words from our co-host here today? Okay, Bill?
I gotta find the pet. This is from Albert Spiess. Quote, "There will come a time when our silence will be more powerful than the voices you are strangling today."
Okay.
I don't know what that means, really, but it was here.
It means that even though they were hanging them to keep them quiet, their deaths and their absence came to reverberate.
Okay. All right. Well, you've been listening to the World Labor Hour, listener-supported community radio station WFT, broadcasting from Champaign, Illinois. And until next week, be safe and power to the people. Take care.